Stories about Iowa's cheap and fertile land drew settlers here from all over the world. When the pioneers came, they all brought something from their homelands. The Germans brought beer. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll start the hour by exploring German brewing traditions in Iowa, specifically in Davenport. I'll talk with the assistant director of the German-American Heritage Center, where the new exhibit Suds is opening this weekend. We'll also talk about Prohibition in Iowa, how Davenport came to be known as one of the most wicked places in the Midwest, and how Scott County became the free and independent state of Scott. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When German settlers came to Iowa, they brought with them a love and knowledge of beer. Today, we'll start the hour by exploring German brewing traditions in Iowa, specifically in Davenport. Then later on, we'll talk about Prohibition in the state, how Davenport became known as one of the wickedest places in the Midwest, and how Scott County came to be known as the free and independent state of Scott. With me now is Kelly Lau. She's assistant director of the German-American Heritage Center in Davenport, where the new exhibit Suds is opening up on Sunday. Hello, Kelly.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Pleasure.
So give me a brief history. When did beer start to be brewed in Davenport?
Basically, as soon as the first 48ers was a large wave of German immigrants, they brought with them a lot of their traditions, and one of those being beer. They actually had a couple of early movements for temperance as early as 1855, but they gained a lot of support during the Civil War with their support of Lincoln, and they had a lot of military experience. So during that time period, the war was on everyone's mind, so temperance kind of took a back seat. Then the temperance movements kind of gained more support after the Civil War, but the breweries kept going.
And what made Davenport kind of a focus point for brewing beer in Iowa?
Well, it was a major stopping point here at the German-American Heritage Center. We were an immigrant hotel right off the river, so a lot of immigrants would come up the Mississippi, stop here in Davenport, and had an immediate place to stay. And a lot of families stayed around here and wrote to their families in Germany to come see Iowa and see what a great place it was.
How many breweries were there in Davenport?
At different points, there was five or six, and then some of them came together under one company as time went on. So,
Can you tell me some of the names of the breweries? Do we still know?
Oh, yes. Actually, can I refer to Merle here on this one, Merle Van Steiner?
Right. Let me introduce Merle.
Yeah, sure.
Merle Van Steiner is a collector of brewery memorabilia in the Quad Cities area, and he provided a lot of the artifacts that will be on display. Hi, Merle.
Hi. How you doing this morning?
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
So tell me about some of these different breweries.
Some of the early breweries were as early as 1850s, the Fromm Brewery in Davenport, the Julius Lierkind Brewery. They were very early breweries. In fact, Julius Lierkind actually in 1893 sold his brewery and moved on to Oregon. But they had a lot of early breweries. Some were small and some were a little bit larger. But they really flourished in Davenport because of the German implication there, you know. And we brewed up until 1956. Actually, was our last brewery, and it was. Then it all went to, of course, microbreweries after that, but the big ones come in and took over. But Davenport really flourished in the brewing industry.
In the 1850s, when they were making this beer in Davenport, were they selling it outside of Davenport? Were they, putting it in wagons and taking it other places?
Well, most of it was sold in Davenport, but in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, some of it was transported. They would ice down cars and ship it to different ports in Illinois and Iowa. Rock Island Brewery, which is right across the river, which is also kind of a combination of the Quad City unit here. They did a lot of shipping of that, and I have old manifests where they showed the beer being shipped, and they ordered it in eighth barrels, quarter barrels, half barrels, and full barrels, and then they'd have an order card because it was difficult to converse back then, so they would just mail these cards back and forth, and the brewery would get the card and say, I want so many barrels of this. And yes, it did leave Davenport too, but a lot of it was sold in this area. I mean, you take an area probably about 50 to 60 miles around. And the reason was, at that time, you know, they had to keep the beer cold because they didn't have the pasteurization and things that they have today, you know, and the ingredients that they used to preserve it. So a lot of the beer, I can imagine,
would have been a tremendous challenge.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. Actually, we have pictures of guys icing the cars where they, you know, pull up and put the ice in the top of the beer cars to keep the refrigeration. And the old wooden cars, which had thick insulation, probably had a sawdust walls between them. And a lot of the ice blocks came right off the river in the wintertime. They would cut the ice in the wintertime and save those in ice houses and then use that all summer long to ice these cars with.
This may be a very hard question to answer, but how would we recognize the beer that they were brewing then? How different would it be from beer people are familiar with today?
Today? Well, actually, some of the beers, they would be what they call a heavier, a stout beer. A lot of the beers that are brewed in Germany would be similar to those things now. Some of the microbreweries, such as the Potosi Brewery up in Wisconsin, Potosi, Wisconsin, they brew a lot of those beers today that would have been very popular back then. And they tried to do a little bit with seasonal beers and so forth, but most of the beers were made and put in kegs then. They didn't, and a few were bottled, but not too many because the bottles and cans didn't really come along much until after Prohibition in the 30s. So.
Sure. Well, you know, I know that many people who enjoy European beers, German beers specifically, look down their noses at American beers. But were these basically the same kind of beers that would have been brewed in Germany at that time?
Absolutely. They were made basically with the same things, with the same malts and barleys and hops and all the ingredients that go into the beers. They were just done in different quantities, and the contents of the beer were a little bit stronger back then. You know, the law in Iowa, I think, was after Prohibition that you could not make anything over 4% alcohol. And previous to that time, I'm sure a lot of those beers were probably 7, 8, 9% even, you know. And they like their strong, dark beer, and even the guys, the German guys today, just love that beer, you know. They call it the API and stuff like that. So, but they love that beer, and it's but basically it was they didn't make the real light beers like they do today. You know, they have lights. Of course, everybody's on a diet, I guess, so you don't drink that kind of, you know.
What kind of artifacts remain from these early breweries?
Well, we have a lot of things. We have barrels, we have the tappers, we have some of the early bottles. I have bottles as early as the 1850s that were actually bottled here in Davenport. They have some openers, they have advertising pieces, lithos of the different breweries, the plants, and so forth, and a lot of pictures. And they have little carts that they wheel the beer around on, you know, different things like that. And most of the beer at that time was also moved around by the horse and wagon, you know. And so these guys had to be pretty strong because a barrel of beer weighed quite a bit, you know, at 8.33 pounds just of water, you know. So.
Do you, and Kelly, you can jump in on this. Have you been able to collect any stories of people who have talked about these beers and these breweries?
Kelly, not so much probably as me. I'm a little bit older than Kelly, so I can relate back to the 40s and 50s, actually, when people did use the beers here in town. And of course, during Prohibition, there was a lot of homebrew going on, so there was a lot of people around that I knew that did homebrew during the Prohibition period. And I knew people from the 1800s and so forth. Like, my grandmother was born in 1877, so I grew up, heard stories from my family about the people that drank the beer and so forth. But the like I always said, that the Germans were the ones that brewed it, and the Irish were the ones that drank most of it. So.
Why has this captured your imagination so much, Merle?
Well, I got into kind of historical things. I love history in Davenport, and I have a vast collection of Davenport history books and so forth. And I had a son that started collecting beer cans back in about 1967, 1970, along in that era. And I went to a lot of shows with him, and I really didn't care much about the beer cans, but I liked the other things that went with it, you know, the things that moved and worked and so forth. So I actually got into that and started collecting that about 40 years ago, and it just became kind of a passion. And you kind of get one thing and then another. It's just like a collector, you know. He thinks he has to have one of everything, and sometimes you get that and even more than that. So,
now, of course, outside of Davenport, there weren't these breweries that people could turn to for beer, so there must have been a big home brewing culture at the time.
Yeah, actually, there was a lot of breweries. Dubuque was a big brewing center. Clinton had some breweries. They had some noted breweries. There was one in Muscatine and down the river, Fort Madison, Keokuk. All the river towns had them. Cedar Rapids had them. Des Moines had them. You know, I mean, it was Sioux City. They were really all over the state. But Davenport was just predominantly German. Everybody, if you didn't have a German name, you weren't too important in Davenport, it seemed like, back years ago. So,
well, and we're going to dig into some of the history of Prohibition in Davenport, which is fascinating, in just a moment. Kelly, before I let you go, though, the exhibit is opening up on Sunday. For people who come to visit, what are they going to find?
Well, first of all, we're going to have an opening lecture by Father George McDaniel of St. Ambrose, and he's going to talk specifically about Prohibition in Iowa. And then we invite everyone to come see the exhibit. We are featuring actually about 209 cans from Germany, and this is part of a collection of over 25,000 cans, beer cans. We have a map from 1900 that will have locations of breweries and taverns in the past and actually today. We have a table and chair set from the 1890s from a tavern called Washington Park. And that building is actually still here today in Davenport. So that's going to be kind of fun to see that table. It has schooner holders, which is kind of a new idea for many people. They're little cubby holes on the side of the table. Then we also have a video from the American Brewing Association in Schlitz on how beer is made and takes you through the process. Then another feature is just some of the brewing traditions. We have information on the German purity law, which kind of determines what ingredients can be used in beer. And a lot of breweries still use that, and that's from 1516.
Oh, wow. And this, how long will the exhibit be open?
That's going to go until October 28th, so we have lots of time for everyone to come stop in and see it.
All right. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Kelly Lau is Assistant Director of the German-American Heritage Center in Davenport, where the new exhibit Suds is opening up on Sunday. Merle Vastein, thank you.
Well, thank you for interviewing us. We really appreciate it.
Merle Vastein is a collector of brewery memorabilia in the Quad Cities area, and he provided many of the artifacts that will be on display throughout this exhibition, which again opens on Sunday and will run through October. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about the Prohibition era in Davenport and how that city became known as one of the wickedest in the Midwest. We'll also talk about the free and independent state of Scott. That and more coming up in a moment on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about brewing culture in Iowa, specifically in Davenport. When the German pioneers came to Iowa, they came looking for inexpensive land, for new opportunities, and they brought with them, of course, knowledge and love of beer. Coming up this weekend, the German-American Heritage Center in Davenport is opening up a new exhibit called Suds. It's opening up on Sunday. And in conjunction with that exhibit, they're bringing in a number of different speakers to talk about the history of beer in Davenport, but also the history of Prohibition in Davenport. And Jane Simonson is one of those speakers. She's an associate professor of history and women's and gender studies at Augustana College in Rock Island. And coming up on June 16th at the German-American Heritage Center, she'll be presenting Crossing Perry Street, a look at Davenport in the Prohibition era. Hello, Jane.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So when did Prohibition become law in Iowa?
Well, in the time period that I'm most familiar with, I know a lot of people, when we think of Prohibition era, we think of the early 20th century. But actually, in Iowa, Prohibition became law in 1884. And so, as you can imagine, many of the German Americans who are already settled here raised their eyebrows at that. And Davenport was particularly known for ignoring that law.
Tell me how they ignored the law. I mean, was there any change in behavior? We were just talking about all the breweries in Davenport. Did they have to change how they did business, or did they just totally flout it?
Well, it eventually changes, and that's one of the parts of the history that's interesting here. You know, originally, when the law passed, the mayor of Davenport, Ernst Claussen, was German. And so a lot of the German-Americans at the time saw that as sort of an assault on their liberties, that actually saloon culture was important for a couple of different reasons in Davenport. One was, of course, because of the German American heritage. So you had, families, respectable middle class families who would visit beer gardens, especially on Sunday afternoons and things like that. So that was an important part of their culture. But Davenport was also a river town. So in addition to respectable places like parks and beer gardens, you also had less respectable places. And what's interesting to me about this is that those are male places. Women do not go into saloons. So that's where, from a perspective of gender history, it becomes interesting, because the protection of drinking culture was protection of German culture, but it was also protection of male culture in Davenport and other river towns.
So how did women who were working for equal rights at that time, how did they respond to this protection?
Well, women were some of the people that were behind Prohibition, of course, and I know people are sort of familiar with the image of the WCTU, Women's Christian Temperance Union, women, marching along very sternly and sometimes wielding an axe and, chopping apart saloons and things like that. But for a lot of women in the 1880s, Prohibition was not just about discontinuing drinking and, not letting men drink. But it was about protecting their freedom to move about city streets, actually. And there's a wonderful book that's on Davenport called The Freedom of the Streets, Work, Citizenship, and Sexuality in the Gilded Age City by Sharon Wood, who went to the University of Iowa. She's now at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. And she studies this interesting phenomenon where, because downtown Davenport was part of this drinking culture, lots of saloons downtown, it was very difficult for working women, and there were quite a few in Davenport in the 1880s and 1890s, to really be on some of those streets and be understood to be respectable women. And there were certain things they couldn't do because of the Davenport saloon culture. Saloons were places where men could go and talk about politics. They could cash checks there. They could get free lunch with a purchase of a beer. There was really no place a working woman could go and eat lunch or go to the bathroom when she was downtown. So it did have a sort of effect on women's other freedoms. And of course, drinking culture was very closely linked to prostitution. And many women saw prostitution as something that women who were in poverty were driven to because of their inability to earn enough wages to support themselves and their families.
How did this culture shape the city of Davenport? Because, of course, Davenport was in Prohibition for a long period, mm-hmm. since it took place in 1884. How did that start to shape neighborhoods?
That's actually a really interesting question. Some of the research that Sharon Wood did, she did some wonderful work with maps and figuring out where saloons and houses of prostitution were. And what she found is in the 1870s, early 1880s, before Prohibition, you had a number of saloons downtown, but you also had a number up by Vanderveer Park in North Davenport, which is now, it was the fairgrounds at the time. But with the onset of Prohibition, you sort of have this movement down towards the riverfront, and increasingly a concentration of a lot of those saloons in the area now known as Bucktown, down by the river. And one of the reasons that this concentration increased is because of the policies that Davenport instituted in the early 1890s to regulate not just saloons, but also prostitution. They actually had a new policy of regulated prostitution and regulated saloon culture that started in the early 1890s.
Tell me about that, because that is not a typical American
approach
to prostitution.
It's hard to tell how many American cities had this. You know, there were certainly informal ways of regulating prostitution and saloons. Like Chicago, of course, has graft and corruption of all kinds. The system that they had in Davenport was actually one that was a semi-legal. It was a policy that another German-American mayor by the name of Henry Vollmer started when he became mayor in 1893. And what they did was they had prostitutes, brothel keepers basically, had to appear in court once a month and pay a fine, but it was pretty much a registration fee. And then each of the women that was working for them had to also pay a fee, and part of that would be that she would be examined by a doctor to make sure she was free of sexually transmitted diseases and things like that. And so what that did would mean that Davenport was sort of able to separate out women who were working as prostitutes from women who were simply workers. Because before that, you know, it was a lot of mixing and mingling on the streets. It was very difficult for people to tell who was just a working class woman and who was a prostitute. In fact, the legal definition of a prostitute at the time was really murky. If a woman were just in a place that was known for prostitution, or if she looked like a prostitute, or if she had a bad reputation, she could be arrested for being a prostitute, whether money had exchanged hands or not. So this was sort of a protective measure that protected men in a lot of ways. So men would be able to tell who was a prostitute and who wasn't, if they were looking to have a good time.
I could see it being framed as a protective measure for women as well, though.
It could be, and in some ways what it did, well, it made the business of prostitution a little more stable for women, I guess, entrepreneurs, in that because there was this sort of recognition of what was going on, it was safer for them. They didn't face constant raids and things like that and getting hauled into to court every so often. But in a lot of ways, you know, there were certainly women in Davenport, like middle class or professional women, who did not see this as the right solution. That they said basically what this meant was that the city had said, well, you know, boys will be boys, and prostitutes are fallen women, morally corrupt. Whereas a lot of them, brothel keepers, tended in some cases to be married women. They had children. They were supporting their children through the money that they were making. So to take an example, if a woman had some daughters and she was a brothel keeper, if her daughters were in the house, they could be arrested as prostitutes, whether they were prostitutes or not, or might have to register as a prostitute, even if they were just living with their mothers. So a lot of women saw this as not really addressing the problem,
right?
Which was that, you know, this sort of turning the head at the moral what they saw as the moral failings of men rather than women. And it's important to remember that the age of consent in Iowa at the time was 13. 13 years old, a girl could consent to sexual relations with a man. And it had recently been raised, I think, 1886 or so, from 10. They saw that as the problem, really, with this drinking culture.
I have to imagine, though, that this regulation of prostitution and thereby basically in many ways supporting prostitution in Davenport and turning the blind eye against all of these saloons, it must have made Davenport a destination for many
Absolutely.
People.
Absolutely, yes. And that's one of the things that also changes in the sort of the geography is, Davenport had already had things like theaters, the Burtis Opera House, and the German community had their own German theater. So it had some theaters. But what happens when people realize that, Davenport is a place where, you pay a fairly hefty tax, but a tax, and you can go ahead and do what you need to do. So all sorts of theaters and dance halls, Brick Munro's Pavilion, which is now the Bucktown Center for the Arts, opens up in the 1890s. And so it really does become a hub. Entertainment hub, especially in that Bucktown area. And part of that was due actually to a new state law in 1894 called the Mulct Tax, which was a tax on saloons particularly. And that helped to regulate saloons and also made a lot of money for Davenport. A lot of Davenporters have heard the legend that our city hall was built with fines imposed on prostitutes, which isn't quite true, but it was probably the money that was made from these regulation fees that helped them build that beautiful city hall that we have.
We're talking about brewing history in Iowa, and right now we're talking about Davenport in the Prohibition era. My guest is Jane Simonson. She's an associate professor of history and women's and gender studies at Augustana College in Rock Island. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. If there are stories passed down through your family of Prohibition times in Iowa, we'd love to hear those stories. If you have questions, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And John is on the line from Waterloo. Hi, John.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest had any background on the racial aspects of the activities. And also, since Big Spiderbeck was from there, occurs to me that music and stuff in the tavern and bar culture.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's a great question about race, because there was an African-American community in downtown Davenport, a little north of the riverfront area where a lot of the saloons were. And what's interesting about the regulation when they started regulating brothel keepers and prostitutes, they did not register African-American prostitutes, which is really intriguing. That suggests that one of the reasons for instituting this was, obviously it's a financial boon, but it does give evidence that this was a measure of protection, but only for certain people. And certainly in Davenport, as elsewhere in the 1880s and 1890s, there wasn't as much concern with protecting, say, African-American women or white men were not assumed to visit those kinds of brothels. So there is definitely a racial aspect to this. When Bucktown starts becoming a hub of leisure culture in the 1890s and into the 20th century, then you do see a little more racial mixing in that area, that these dance halls and things were open to a wide variety of people. And that was part of the concern, is that there was so much class and race mixing that went on in there. I don't know as much about the music culture.
Well, I was going to bring that up, because it does seem like with all of the drinking and the prostitution, you also have an environment where arts and culture could thrive.
Yeah, and I know that they did definitely hire, they would hire girls to sing in some of these dance halls, bring them in from Chicago, and you did have lots of live performance acts then making stops in Davenport. And you can see that in newspaper articles, and they would perform not just in Bucktown, but, make the rounds through what was then called Watchtower Park, now Black Hawk State Historic Site, and in other kind of concert venues in Davenport. So I'm sure that is part of the reason that the music culture thrived here as well, is that when you have entertainment, you have all that goes with it.
You have described Davenport as being known as one of the wickedest places in the Midwest. When Prohibition ended, how did that change?
that's an interesting question. You know, this was where Davenport was sort of part of a nationwide phenomenon of crusades against vice, which would be, you know, drinking and prostitution and all kinds of social evils. And that actually starts, you know, before the 1920s around, well, in Davenport, I would say, even around 1905, there starts being a pushback against places like Bucktown, where the Catholic Church and other church and religious groups and social reform groups start pushing for ending this, what they saw as this vice district in Davenport. And one of the methods they tried was just to say, well, okay, no women can come into the saloons in Bucktown, because they thought that would be the way to solve the problem of prostitution. But you get a lot of discussion in the early 20th century about what was called white slavery, this idea that innocent working women would sort of stumble into the trap of prostitution, say if they were hired as a singer or a waitress, that they would, fall victim to those who were trying to conscript them into prostitution. In Chicago, of course, was a real focus for concerns over vice. But you do get this movement throughout the U.S. In the 1910s, 1915. The nation passed an act in 1910 called the Mann Act, but it's also known as the White Slave Traffic Act, which said that, I'm trying to remember the specifics, if a woman crosses a state line for immoral purposes, she's not necessarily a prostitute, but she's a victim. And so they would, prosecute the person who brought her over state lines. So there is a sort of crackdown on this culture of immorality, even beginning before the
Prohibition
era. Prohibition.
Mm-hmm. Jane, thank you so much for talking with
us
today.
You're welcome.
Jane Simonson is an associate professor of history and women's and gender studies at Augustana College in Rock Island. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about brewing history in Iowa, the traditions that the German pioneers brought with them when they came to settle the frontier in Iowa. And we've been talking about mainly the city of Davenport, because there is a new exhibition going on at the German-American Heritage Center exploring this history. It's called Suds. It opens up on Sunday. So we've been talking about brewing history in Davenport, and also Davenport in the Prohibition era. And during that Prohibition era, as we've heard, Davenport made up a lot of their own rules. And they weren't alone. In fact, the entire county, Scott County, made up a lot of their own rules. And in fact, it was known by many as the independent state of Scott. There is a movie that has been made about a celebration of the state of Scott in 1948, and Bob King, who is editor and general manager of Classic Images, Films of the Golden Age magazine as well, is here with us to talk about this movie. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And before we talk about the movie, can you help give us a little bit of history of this state of Scott idea? Scott County is older than the state of Iowa, right?
That is correct. It was formed under the authority of the Wisconsin Territorial Legislature in 1837. That's 9 years before Iowa gained statehood.
So the fact that Scott County really predated the state of Iowa, did that create some sort of conflicts between Scott County?
Well, we kind of theorized that helped give us this kind of independent spirit here. But also there is that more open, kind of wide open atmosphere that you had on river towns, Mississippi river towns. They were different from the little towns in the hinterland, you know. They were not so straight-laced.
So where did this rallying cry, the free and independent state of Scott, when did that originate?
Well, the free and independent state of Scott is a conscious echo of the free and independent state of Schleswig-Holstein. And that was the rallying cry of the rebels in Schleswig-Holstein who rebelled against the authority of the Danish king after 1848. So what happened was the king, of course, didn't like this idea that part of his kingdom was going to be cut away, and so he put down the rebellion with force. And he even exiled some of the people. And so a lot of these Schleswig-Holsteiners left. They came to America, and some of them came to Scott County. And the most prominent of these people was Hans Claussen. And Hans Claussen was actually exiled. He was a leader of the rebellion. And so he had this, this free and independent state of Schleswig-Holstein in his blood. And it just so happened that his son was the mayor of Davenport. He would become the mayor of Davenport later in the 19th century, right at precisely the time when the Prohibition battle was heating up. And you see, these people who came from Schleswig-Holstein were very conscious that they needed to fight against governmental oppression. And so they thought, well, wait a minute, this business, the government, the state of Iowa, is not allowing us to drink beer? That sounds like old-style European oppression. We're not going to stand for that. We're going to be like our forefathers who stood up against the tyranny of the Danish king. We're going to stand up against the tyranny of the state of Iowa. We're going to proclaim the free and independent state of Scott. Of course, just jokingly in a way, but not jokingly in the respect that they weren't going to obey all these laws. They just weren't going to obey them. They were going to fight the authority of Des Moines.
And it sounds, from my conversation with Jane Simonson a moment ago, it sounds like not so much that they fought the authority of Des Moines, but they just ignored the authority of Des Moines.
Yes, well, that's putting a fine point on it, I suppose.
But this rallying cry, the free and independent state of Scott, did that become a big thing? Was that echoed across homes all through Scott County?
Well, you can bet that it was very disturbing to the authorities in Des Moines to have this independent spirit. Very disturbing to know that their laws wouldn't be enforced. And this was actually a real chafing point. I mean, it sounds like, we kind of look back at it now and think, oh, this is all kind of funny, people pretending to be a free and independent state in this county. But actually, the people in Des Moines didn't take too kindly
to this idea.
Didn't
think it was funny.
They didn't think it was so funny.
I think I could imagine how they would have responded.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, in the 1970s, when one of the Davenport mayors was thinking of reviving the State of Scott celebrations, he was told to drop the idea, drop it like a hot potato, because the people in Des Moines don't like this whole State of Scott business. And guess what? We're dependent on Des Moines for a lot of state money. So forget about it.
So it's still a sore point, possibly.
Well, it was in the 1970s anyway.
So with the idea of a State of Scott, was there actually sort of a faux government formed?
Well, they had, I guess you could say, faux positions anyway. There was a governor of the State of Scott. And that's one of the interesting things about this film, the State of Scott film. The governor at the time, the 1947-48 governor, was Alfred Christian Mueller. His grandfather was Hans Claussen, one of the leaders of the rebellion against the King of Denmark. So we actually have a governor of the State of Scott who has this historical pedigree that links him to this history.
Oh, that's fascinating. And this film was made in 1948. It recorded that year's State of Scott celebrations. Had there been State of Scott celebrations every year leading up to that point?
Well, I don't know how many of them there were, but we do know that the modern State of Scott celebrations were only 3 years, 46, 47, and 48. And the 1946 one began as part of the celebration of Iowa Centennial, so 100 years of Iowa statehood. But the people of Scott County put their own perverse little twist on it. They weren't just celebrating Iowa statehood. They were celebrating this free and independent state of Scott. So like in their first parade that they had in the 46 celebration, they actually had a fellow who was impersonating the governor of the state of Iowa, kind of like giving mock obedience to him, kind of making a fool of him. While at the same time, in a place of honor, they had their governor of the state of Scott riding in an open car.
I can imagine this chafed a bit, even in 1946.
This is thumbing your nose at Des Moines.
Oh, wow. And so there. Tell me more about what the celebration included. There was a parade.
Okay, so it's this massive community organization. You know, a lot of, well, like in Davenport today, we have the Bix Festival. And it's the same thing, where just hundreds and hundreds of people get together to work to put on some massive community celebration. And thousands and thousands of local people go to see it and participate in some way. And, you know, of course, it's all about, you know, weaving the fabric of the community together and building pride in the community and all that. And so they had all kinds of things going on. And the big thing, of course, was the big parade down through downtown Davenport. But one of the historically one of the most interesting things, well, you do see downtown Davenport the way it was before the widespread use of the automobile and the shopping center destroyed the downtown area. And that is just a priceless gem, just to be able to see that, mm-hmm. the way the downtown was when it drew people in from all over the area. It was a major retail area. But also we have a sequence in the film that shows the inauguration of the new governor. And it shows the, and this is the governor of the state of Scott, of course, not the real governor
right,
of the state of Iowa.
The faux governor.
Yeah. And it shows his senators and his colonels. So these are like honorary positions, prominent men in the community who are given these, the senators were from Davenport and the colonels were from from Scott County. So there's all this participation of all the towns in the county. And you actually see them go through an inauguration ceremony on this temporary stage that was erected in the infield of the Davenport Municipal Stadium. So that is just a real neat slice of history that you get to see in this film.
Who took this film?
Well, it seems to have been commissioned by the Chamber of Commerce of Davenport. And they had some, some very talented. They must have been a professional filmmakers, but they didn't use 35-millimeter film. They used 16-millimeter film. They used Kodachrome reversal film, so it's in color. And since it was reversal film, we don't have a lot of prints of it. There was only, reversal film is basically where you take the camera negative and make a positive print out of it. So there's only this one copy. And that's why the Davenport Public Library just recently applied for a grant from the National Film Preservation Foundation and had a modern copy struck. Because although Kodachrome is excellent film, it does age and deteriorate. So we wanted a new copy, and Davenport Public Library got that done. And that is, this new copy is going to be publicly screened for the first time on Saturday, the 16th of June, at the Mary Crest Senior Center.
Who preserved this film? How was it kept?
It was kept by the Davenport Public Library. Apparently, sometime along the line, the Chamber of Commerce or whoever owned the film turned it over to Davenport Public Library. So it's been in the Special Collections Department there for decades now.
So it's in color, which is surprising for when it was taken.
Kodachrome was invented way back in the 20s. They started working on Kodachrome.
But it's also silent. There's no sound that accompanies
it. No sound, right.
How long is the film?
It's about 30 minutes.
So you see the parade, you see the downtown. What else do you see?
You see, as I say, that the inauguration sequence is very important historically. And you also see the various events that are going on. So you see things like the bicycle races. So you're seeing like real Scott County kids engaging in this bicycle race. And you see a roller soapbox derby. You see there's a fishing contest, and there's just all sorts of community events. You see the Royal American Show's carnival downtown with all the people enjoying the rides. And you see a lot of neat views of Scott County, too. The sequence at the beginning is especially well done, I thought, where it shows all these different forms of transportation. So you get the feeling that all these people are coming into Scott County to participate in the event. So you see an airplane fly into the Moline Airport, and they brought fresh flowers from Hawaii. They made leis with these flowers, and they put the leis around the neck of Alfred Christian Mueller, who's the governor of the state of Scott. So United Airlines is, you know, honoring him. You see the Rock Island Lines passenger train coming into town, which, of course, is a real colorful piece of history. You see the barges going down the Mississippi loaded with coal. It's just all kinds of really nice shots, buses. buses crossing the Centennial Bridge between Rock Island and Davenport. You see cars driving along River Drive. It's just a really beautifully made film.
You have identified, obviously, the governor of the state of Scott. You mentioned the kids who were riding bikes downtown. Have you been able to identify any of the other people who are in the film? Because I'm sure many of those people are still alive.
Yes. Well, that's one of the neat things. One of the local Davenport, I should say Quad Cities, public television station did a documentary. And this was back, I believe, about 20 years ago. And they identified, and they actually interviewed, in their film, now we're not going to be showing this film, the public television film actually has interviews with some of these kids now, of course, grown up and older now. So, yeah, we know the names of a lot of them. And, of course, we have newspaper accounts, too, the Davenport Democrat and the Davenport Daily Times has stories that identify, like, the winners of the contest. So, yes, we do have a lot of the names.
Well, this is such a treasure. And now, because there is a new copy, you'll be able to show it to many more people.
Right. But, of course, it is on 16-millimeter film. And that means that only a few people are capable of showing that anymore. They don't make 16-millimeter film projectors anymore. And you have to be very careful when you show a 16-millimeter film these days. You can't let anybody show it, and you can't use any projector, because most projectors that exist now are in poor working condition, and they will damage the film. So you just can't allow it to be shown willy-nilly.
Is anyone working to make a different kind of copy of the film so it can be preserved and more widely shown?
Yes. Well, we do have it on video, too.
Okay.
So we can show in fact, at the German-American Center later this summer, I will be showing my own video copy of the film. So it's just going to be shown on a video projector. But the one at Marycrest on June 16th, that will actually be showing the new 16-millimeter print of the film.
You know, Bob, when I think about people looking at this film, particularly people who have lived in Davenport for a long time, I would guess that there is sort of a state of Scott pride that gets brought out by looking at this film.
Oh, yes, yes. This is just, I just love to watch this film. I've watched it so many times I can't even tell you. And because, of course, you know, I was born in Iowa City, but I grew up in Davenport. And I just, actually, when I was a kid, when I was 9 years old, I kind of fell in love with this town. This film really takes you back to the way it used to be when downtown Davenport was king, you know?
Well, Bob, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome.
Do you think, are you going to run for governor of the state of Scott?
Well, I doubt that they would pick me. I'm not the political type.
Well, I don't know.
I would vote for Alfred Christian Mueller, to tell you the truth.
All right. Well,
we'll bring him back.
Sounds like the beginning of a new campaign.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Bob.
You're welcome.
Bob King is the editor and general manager of Classic Images and Films of the Golden Age magazine. We've been talking about a film that was made in 1948 to record the year's annual State of Scott celebration in Davenport. And this is all part of a new exhibit that is opening at the German-American Heritage Center in Davenport. The new exhibit is called Suds, and it takes a look at brewing history in the city of Davenport and German-Americans in Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. You can ask questions about things you've heard on the show. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from some young gardeners in Ames who received a surprise package from the White House. And, of course, it's Horticulture Day. We'll be taking your plant questions as well. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.